Hi, and welcome to the Animal Training Academy podcast show, the show for animal training and behavior nerds, where I, Ryan Cartledge, interview the world's most proficient animal training and behavior geeks. We're absolutely thrilled and grateful to have you here with us today. So make sure you hit that subscribe button on whatever you're listening to this on so that you don't miss a single episode. Each episode of this show is brought to you on behalf of the ATA membership. And if you like the conversations in this episode, then you're invited to continue them with like-minded behavior nerds within the membership area, which you can find out more about at www.animaltrainingacademy.com. Once part of the ATA tribe, you'll get access to twice monthly live web classes, the back catalogue of previous web class replays, plus a huge library of videos and projects to help problem solve your training challenges. Plus, we're a sociable bunch with an exclusive private Facebook group and forum areas. It's like a Netflix social media platform for animal behavior geeks. But we will get started on today's episode where we will be talking to one, Sarah Streming. Sarah is the founder of The Cognitive Canine, a dog trainer, dog agility and obedience competitor, and dog behavior consultant. Sarah travels the globe helping dogs and handlers understand each other better. Her credentials include a Bachelor's of Science degree in psychology from Colorado State University and more than a decade in the field of dog training and behavior, with her special interest area being problem solving for performance dogs. Sarah's committed to education and growth in the field of dog training and attends the innovative training conference Clicker Expo every year. In addition to offering seminars internationally, she coaches teams online and is a faculty member at Fenzi Dog Sports Academy. So without further ado, it's my great pleasure to welcome Sarah Streming to the show today, who is patiently waiting by. Sarah, good morning to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me, Ryan.
Oh, you're welcome. Hey, this is the first podcast I've ever done where apparently I've said so without further ado correctly, because a podcast listener messaged me and said that I've been starting every single show by saying without further ado, which apparently is me saying in French goodbye. So I'm starting every podcast episode off up until this one here by saying goodbye to everyone.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
And if you are another popular podcaster in the dog training realm, apparently there's a few of us that do that. So my ripples have been spreading.
Yeah.
In a bad way.
Exactly.
Hey, we've had the pleasure of meeting, which I can't say for all of my guests, and you've been to New Zealand a couple of times, so you're pretty busy traveling around the world and connecting with people that you're training online. So I'm assuming you're training people in Fenzi and then...
Yeah. So we've got to hang out face-to-face twice, because I've been to New Zealand twice to teach. I do travel a lot to teach, mostly within the continental US, but I am lucky enough to go overseas a couple of times a year. And then my primary work is online, coaching both private clients and the people that take my courses on Fenzi Dog Sports Academy.
Awesome. And big shout out to our mutual friend Annie Thorne for organizing those New Zealand workshops. She is an absolute legend. Hey, Sarah, let's rewind your tape a little bit, because I'm interested to, because you've done a degree in psychology, which is pretty awesome. I'm interested to know how that kind of factors into your animal training now. But let's go back even further than that. Can you tell the listeners of this show where you got started, where you first learned about positive reinforcement animal training? And we love stories. So any stories that stick out from that time?
So as far as when I got started in positive reinforcement-based animal training, that happened a little bit later. I started out just kind of as a lot of us do, being a kid that was obsessed with animals, primarily dogs. I don't really remember a time in my life where dogs weren't kind of number one in my mind for everything. And eventually my parents kind of realized that the dog thing wasn't a phase and got me a, they got me a border collie, and his name was Kelso. And my whole goal with him was I wanted to compete in dog agility, because I saw dog agility on the television when I was pretty little, like 8 or 9, and something inside me clicked. And I knew that I needed to be doing that. So I messed around kind of training the dogs that we already had on some backyard agility, and also took some pretty terrible agility training classes that I, of course, thought were wonderful. So that's all fine. And then when I got Kelso, I wanted to go to a specific training school, and they required us to take obedience classes before we could go into agility classes. So I also got interested in competitive obedience with him. So he competed in both of those sports and kind of got me started, but he was different and special in the fact that he, at 10 weeks of age, right out the gate, displayed some really aggressive behaviors towards other dogs. And he was doing that if I had him in public, and he was also doing it in the puppy classes that we were in. And so right off the bat, I was faced with a pretty tremendous challenge. And most of the advice that I was given was very, very well-intentioned, but not well-informed. So basically, I was told to do a lot of pretty heavy-handed corrections with him when it came to the aggression stuff. And that, you know, we could talk for another 2 hours about the problems that that created between he and I. But, you know, long story a little bit shorter is that we did get to a point where he was competing, and he finished some upper level titles in both sports before I retired him when he was eight or nine years old. But I was hooked, even though he was really difficult to show. I was still, for some reason, really enamored with this competing with dogs thing and the training with dogs thing. It wasn't until later in his life that I really embraced and learned more positive reinforcement based techniques. And I remember, actually, I was reading Gene Donaldson's book, The Culture Clash, and I was probably, I don't know, 15 or 16, maybe 17 years old. And I got Kelso when I was 14. And she spells it out pretty plainly in The Culture Clash that we really have no business using physical corrections or punishment-based techniques at all in dogs. And as only Jean is really capable of doing, I mean, she just spells it out in very plain English that is very hard to argue with. And that was kind of a turning point for me. And I remember training him. We were working on one of the exercises for utility, which is the highest level in competitive obedience in the United States. And it was an exercise that he kind of struggled with. And I read her book, and then I went to training class, and I had this kind of light bulb of the fact that if he was doing it right, it wasn't because of the punishment for doing it wrong that I was doling out. It was because of the reinforcement for doing it right that I was giving him. So in that particular exercise, I stopped using any kind of correction and just gave him a click and a treat every single time he did it right. And before long, he was never doing it wrong. And it was just a really big kind of light bulb for me that all of these corrections that my mentors thought were necessary to get reliable behavior were not necessary, because positive reinforcement can and does speak for itself. It doesn't need other things to kind of back it up. So I would like to say that from that point forward, I never corrected a dog again, but that's not true. It still, you know, took a long time and a lot of working with dogs to figure out how to make positive reinforcement do all of the amazing things that it can do for me, because it's not how I learned originally. And then I got Iggy, who she's still here, and she's going to turn 11 actually soon. And I was really committed to not using corrections with her. And I was really committed to kind of doing it right in my mind. And I trained Iggy completely differently from how I train today, but it was a huge step forward for me away from the way that I originally learned to train. And all along, I knew that I wanted to do this professionally. Maybe not all along, but pretty early when I was maybe 16 or 17, I was pretty sure that helping people with their dogs was something that I wanted to do. And so that's why I actually got the psychology degree, because it seemed actually like the most relevant degree that I could get to me, because you have your behavioral science, you have learning theory, that's all psychology, as well as your primary job as a dog trainer is helping the people who are attached to the dogs and communicating with them. And so some of the most helpful courses actually that I took in school were the counseling psych classes. So actually learning better how to talk to people. And I still reference my counseling psych textbook from time to time when I'm trying to communicate best with a client. And at the time, you know, there's more and more relevant kind of applied animal behavior areas of study. But at the time, I really couldn't find much. And I did reach out to a couple of people who had PhDs in kind of relevant fields who were working as animal behaviorists and didn't get much feedback at all. So I just went for it, went and got the psych degree. And then kind of made a choice from there as to whether I wanted to continue in school or go back or go into the field and kind of get my education in the field. And I went into the field. And I'm happy that I did. And I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the right path for everybody. But if I have strength as a trainer, it is probably the sheer number of dogs that I have worked with right in front of me. You know, and then through college, I actually worked for someone who refers to herself as a behaviorist. I today disagree with that distinction, but that's not really relevant at this point. She was a dog trainer, actually, and a pretty old school one at that. So I worked for her thinking that she did what I wanted to do. Realized that, yes, helping people and their dogs is what I want to do, but not the way that she was doing it. So eventually I branched out on my own and started teaching some classes and learning by doing and screwing a lot of things up, as well as getting some stuff right and also kind of continuing down that positive reinforcement path and learning everything that I could about using non-invasive or the least invasive techniques with dogs, and grew a pretty robust in-person behavior and training business in Colorado, where I'm from, where I taught agility classes and competitive obedience classes, and I worked with private clients from kind of those sectors, as well as I worked out of a veterinary clinic seeing behavior clients. And the veterinary clinic was in a pretty rural, relatively low-income area. And so I got really good at helping people do the best that they could do, even if it wasn't necessarily the best for the dogs or for everybody involved. I'm thinking of one situation in particular, and we're going to dive into this stuff later, but you know, the dog, they basically came in and wanted the dog euthanized. And the veterinarian that I worked with does not euthanize on demand. So she, you know, dig a little deeper and find out that the dog is escaping the yard and biting people, essentially. So she said, you know, I want you to meet with Sarah. And then after that, you know, if we all get together and decide that's the right path, then okay, but you need to at least do this first. Luckily, they actually did, because a lot of the time they just went straight to the shelter and left the dog there, where probably that is where the dog ended. But I sat with these people and kind of found out that we could elevate a few things about this dog's life and then it would actually probably all be okay. So we went from, you know, free feeding, you know, large bowl of grocery store low-end kibble to maybe the next highest up kibble in a, and I had them literally put it in a milk jug. I said, "Do you guys drink milk?" They said, "Yes." I said, "Okay, great. You know that plastic jug? You're going to poke holes in it that the kibble can fit through, and you're going to fill that with the kibble every day and put that in the yard instead of the bowl that is full." And just little changes like that to make this dog's life, which was going to be relegated to the backyard. The dog wasn't allowed inside and wasn't taken off property. So to just kind of enrich that dog's life a little bit. And to my knowledge, the dog went on to live the rest of its life doing some kind of minor enrichment things in its backyard and stopped escaping and biting people. So, as a trainer who knows a lot of things, what you want to do is you want to walk in and change everything about the way that these people are taking care of this dog. Because to me, dogs should be on the couch and worshipped. And so it's hard for me to understand having a dog that just lives in your backyard that you throw food at a couple of times a day. But getting really good at meeting those people where they were remains a huge lesson for me and one of my strengths, I think, as a trainer now. And then today I share my life with my partner, who's also in the field of dogs. She's a sports medicine veterinarian, and then our 7 dogs. So 6 border collies and 1 Australian shepherd. And my evolution has just been towards thinking about how do I meet these people in the middle and then also elevate these dogs' lives so that they can be what the people want them to be, essentially. And if I had to describe myself as a trainer, because I'm not keen on the labels like positive or force-free, or I think that those labels kind of miss the mark, as labels often do. And so I like to say that I take the dog's experience into account every time. And I care about being effective a lot. And I care about helping people do what they are capable of doing rather than asking them to do something they can't, but always taking the dog's experience of the situation into account, which I think is very, very important in the field of performance dog training, because I think it is skipped over a lot of the time. I think a lot of people refer to themselves as quote unquote positive trainers because of what they're omitting, because of what they're leaving out of their training. Like, they don't use a prong collar anymore, so they call themselves positive. But I think there's a lot of stuff going on, especially in dog agility, which is the sport that I'm the most passionate about, that don't take the dog's experience into consideration. Just kind of takes the results into consideration. And even though people are not necessarily doing things that are overtly cruel or punishing to the dogs, sometimes I think we're doing things to them that help us in competition that maybe don't help them live their life and be a good dog. And good dog meaning a dog that gets to experience things in the world and feel safe every day. So I did that thing that your listeners, that your guests always do, which is I passion talked and went on a tangent. But that's where I'm at now. And I'm really interested in helping, like you said, helping dogs and people understand each other better so that we can all live this kind of cohesive existence that I think we were kind of meant to live.
Going back to the start of your story, it seems like after 105 episodes, and I think, your podcast show, which we didn't even mention at the start there, go listen to Sarah's podcast show. We'll link to all of us in the write-up. There's kind of like a recipe potentially for becoming a successful positive reinforcement trainer. That's be obsessed with animals when you're young, get an aggressive dog, and then use punishment on it for a couple of years, and then stumble across positive reinforcement. There's your recipe.
It's literally all of us. It's so many of us in the field, obsessed with dogs, got a dog with very problematic behavior, tried to suppress that behavior with punishment for way too long, finally saw the light, went to the revival, became changed beings. It's so true. It's so many of us.
And you had that light bulb moment after reading The Culture Clash.
Yes, very much so. She was really instrumental, as well as Dr. Patricia McConnell was really a big influence over me early on. What's interesting about Dr. McConnell is that she and Jean are very different communicators. And so I actually misinterpreted a lot of what Dr. McConnell wrote to allow for more physicality with my dogs. Because she said she trains all her dogs to do a 30-minute downstay, but didn't really say how. And this is not a criticism of her, because I think she's fantastic. It's a criticism of the fact that I had access to, I had her in one ear, and then I had my original dog training mentors in the other ear. And so they both came together to mean 30-minute downstay, in which the dog gets up and you physically make them get back every single time until the dog gives up and stays. And so versus that, and then I read Jean, who, like, I needed to be slapped in the face with it. And Jean's very good at that.
And Arant, was it before or after getting Edgy?
All of this would be before I got Edgy.
Before. Cool. And then you went to university, you studied psychology. And one thing you mentioned that you took away from that was the behaviorist side of things, which if my learning history from talking to people that have done degrees like this is a small fraction of the entire learning.
Oh, it literally, we talked about the four quadrants of operant conditioning, and then we talked about classical conditioning, and we talked about it for 20 minutes tops in one class. And then we were told that it doesn't actually matter because it's irrelevant to human psychology.
To human psychology, they said it's irrelevant. Right. Right. Did they have any animal components in that degree?
No, I really didn't. There were certainly studies involving animals that we looked at from time to time, which is why it's interesting that there's this kind of arrogant divide of, you know, saying, oh, no, we work with people and these things don't work on people. And then over here, we're doing studies on rats and cages and applying it to what we're doing in people. So that's confusing to me. But that was definitely, I think the only times we talked about animals would have been in referencing research, most of which being drug trials, as well as, let's see, what was it called? It was a course on is the physiology of psychology. There was a lot of discussion of the brain, and you can't really like just cut open human brains and poke around, but they do with a lot of unfortunate animals that are in labs. So that would be the only discussion really on animals that happened. And I was kind of starved for there to be a little bit more animal stuff. And so that's why in the meantime, I was working under the woman who refers to herself as a behaviorist, and then also training a lot of dogs. And I worked in four different dog daycare settings also throughout college. So it's getting my kind of dog needs fulfilled that way, and learning and continuing to compete with Kelso. Whereas in school, yeah, it was pretty much void of any discussion on animals.
I have more questions here, but I wanted just to focus on something else you talked about, and that is how to meet people. In your words, I think, I've probably butchered my quotation of you. How to meet people in the middle and elevate their dogs' lives. And you talked about meeting people where they are, which is a journey that I'm on as well. And I'm reinforced for it, going from my increase in behavior of doing that.
Yes,
but
yes.
I still have this cognitive dissonance. I was hoping to talk to you about that. So, like, you know, I'm doing it, I'm reinforced for it, get good results from my clients and ATA members and people I'm working with. But there's still this, like, so I'm a vegan. Mm-hmm. But when I used to eat meat a couple of years ago, like, I always had cognitive dissonance. Like, I'd eat it, but like, it would just feel wrong. Like, it's that same feeling. Like, it's weird, you know. It's like, I'm meeting people where they are. I'm not jumping on that bandwagon, and I'm doing it more, but I just have that underlying, yeah. It's in my chest.
And it can be really, I hold pretty firm beliefs about kind of what I think a dog's life, an ideal dog's life, looks like. And there's certainly differences from dog to dog, but for the most part, I think that their needs are relatively universal. And I find that you know, yes, that's where I have to meet people in the middle, because if I say I want you to do all of these things that are a complete 180 from what you've been doing, that's really, really hard for them. And so what I like to think of it as is just splitting for humans. So rather than lumping all of your instructions on them and all of your requests for them to change, split it down so that they can be successful, because the best learning, I believe strongly, comes through success and not failure. So if people are feeling constantly bad about themselves and about the way that they are able to provide for their dogs, then we're not getting anywhere. Whereas if they can make some small changes, and then that behavior is reinforced in them by seeing the differences in their dogs, then they do more and more and more. Whereas if I just walk in and say, everything you're doing is wrong and I want you to do all of these things completely differently and your life changes tomorrow, all that ever serves to do is make people feel bad about themselves. It is very difficult in particular situations, like in the dog sport world, which is my primary clientele now. Dog sport people are the people who, you know, spend more money on dog food than on their own food. And their dogs probably get all of this great body work that they probably don't shell out the cash for, especially in the United States, where you have to shell out the cash for it. And they, you know, they really feel like they are bending over backwards as is to provide for their dogs. And so if I step in and say, oh, but you're missing this, this, and this, that's a tough pill for them to swallow. And it's also a tough pill for me to swallow that culturally, in the dog sport world, the things that I'm talking about are not embraced. It's different in different countries, and, you know, we're going to get into some of these things, but in the United States, when I talk about making certain changes, I am met with huge backlash because of kind of these cultural beliefs around what dogs should do. Like, dogs should be marched around on a leash around the neighborhood twice a day because that's healthy for them. Or they should be, you know, there's still a lot of people who are doing a lot of confinement so that the dogs are confined unless they're working, and things like that. And so it's hard for me too sometimes, but if I just remember that lumping never gets me anywhere with anybody, then it's easier for me to just go, okay, I need to split for this person. What's the finest split that I can think of where they can start?
Good. It's not just me then.
No, definitely not.
Split it down so they can be successful. Then that horrible word should.
Right.
People thinking about what their dogs
right.
Should do. Hey, can you bring everyone listening now up to 2020? Because that's the date it will be when we release this.
Right.
And tell them what you're up to now. I mean, we've touched on it numerous times, but remind them. And also where they can go to find out more and listen to your podcast, etc.
Sure. So today, I mentioned that we have seven dogs. So there are seven dogs in the household, but two of them are mine, quote unquote. So I'm primarily training Iggy. She's retired from agility, but I'm working on getting her into the AKC obedience realm. And I'm playing around with some scent work with her, and because it's important to me that she gets to keep doing things forever. And Felix is my 4-year-old border collie that has taught me all kinds of things. And so he and I are working on agility and obedience both as well. And he's really my odyssey with him in particular is a lot about dealing with dogs who just their behaviors change immensely dependent on the reinforcers at play, which I think is a big thing that people are not acknowledging as what it is in dog agility. So we're just calling it arousal most of the time in dog agility. And I would say that a lot of the time it has to do with the path to reinforcement not being clear, and then the dog having very big life or death feelings about the reinforcer. So there are always levels of reinforcers. For Felix, the ball on rope is life or death. So if I make the ball on rope, the reinforcer for whatever it is that I'm trying to teach him. Anytime he gets it wrong, which will happen, right? Like I try not to have them get it wrong a lot. I try to set them up mostly for success. But anytime he gets it wrong and I withhold the ball on rope, it is like Christmas is canceled. Everyone died. It is the worst. And he has his feelings about it are too big. So it's not helpful for us. Whereas I think mostly in dog sports, they want to elevate their reinforcers to that life or death level so that the dog will work really, really hard. But there's this balance that needs to be achieved where the dog doesn't feel like life or death are on the line so that they're actually able to think and function and learn, because we're like that too. I mean, if we say, you know, get this right, or I take your paycheck for the next 6 months, get this right, or we light your car on fire. Like this is not, or, you know, if you get this thing that I've loosely taught you to do correctly, you get $1 million. I mean, this is like way too important. These contingencies are way too hard to deal with. And so Felix has really shown me that, because in dog agility, like I said, like a lot of the foundation training that I taught Iggy, my first positive reinforcement based dog, was based in building my reinforcers up to a life or death kind of level. And she worked really great with it because she's that dog that just makes me look good no matter what I do. But Felix, you don't get to have two of those. So Felix is not that. And is like, no, lady, you made me think life or death on this ball and rope. So that's now going to plague every training session. So that's what I am really working with him and playing with, you know, what reinforcers are best in what situation and how do I deliver them in the smartest possible way to get the behavior that I want to get. And to me, that's like what I would call like positive reinforcement 2.0. So rather than like, you know, the base level was I am going to omit correction and I'm going to allow positive reinforcement to speak for itself. And then 2.0 is, okay, and now how do I manipulate the positive reinforcement on such a level that I can achieve whatever the behavior is that I'm after just by manipulating the type of reinforcer and the delivery of reinforcer. So that's kind of the current thing that I'm obsessed with my dogs right now. And I haven't been competing for about a year. I'm looking at getting back into both obedience and agility soon. But it's been kind of a year of just asking my dogs questions in my little training studio and figuring some things out. And it's been good.
Sounds awesome. And so are you sharing this story on your blog and your website and in your podcast, and where can people go to follow along?
Yes. So the Cognitive Canine, and that's canine spelled out, .com is my website. Everything is there. My blog and my podcast are both there. My podcast is Cog Dog Radio, and you can subscribe on any of the podcast platforms to that. And then Cog Dog Radio also has a Facebook page, and so does the Cognitive Canine. So if you are more kind of into that platform, you can follow. I always post the podcasts online, so you can follow both of those on Facebook. And then I'm getting better at Instagram. Cognitive_canine has an Instagram account now, realizing that that's more the way of the future. So I'm working on making sure that all of my stuff gets put out on Instagram as well.
Me too, but
it's hard.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because if it's hard, like we have to question where the reinforcers are. You know, like
that's probably what I'm now going to think about when I go walk my dogs later. Well, I'm just going to think about why Instagram feels hard to me.
Yeah.
And I'll let you know what I think of, because it's an interesting question.
Well, they're just removed in New Zealand. Have they done the same in the States, where you can see how many people have liked your latest picture or whatever?
I don't even know the answer to that, but I don't think so, but that's interesting. And that's like a removal of a big reinforcer if they did that.
Yeah. They don't want people to feel, comparing itis and.
Oh, interesting.
So I think we were a trial country. Yeah. Let's try it out in New Zealand.
They were like, if anybody wants everybody to feel equal, it's going to be the Kiwis. So let's try it there.
But I'm standing here saying I don't feel like a reinforced Instagram.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I do. I like it. It's I open the app up and I spend too long in there.
Oh, totally. Every time. And maybe that's part of it. I don't know. But it's not like Facebook isn't a time suck too. So I don't know.
And we'll link to all of this stuff in the show notes as well. Hey, you used the word Odyssey in there. Was that, it's a word we use often on the ATA podcast. Or do you, are you also an Odyssey word user?
I use it intentionally because of the podcast that I am on. Yeah. But I like it because I dislike the word journey. And I feel like I'm going to start using the word Odyssey more.
They're both pretty epic words.
They are.
They are. We love learning about people's behavioral odysseys. So yes. Thank you very much, Sarah, for sharing all of that. Moving forward, I'd really like to talk about something I know you've alluded to numerous times in that first passion talk of yours.
Right.
Passion talk 2.0 coming up, everyone. Because this is something you're very passionate about. And I've both seen you speak live on some of this stuff. And we've been honored to have you on an ATA members only web class as a special guest, where you paired up with our other favorite Sarah of the Owings variety. You and Sarah Owings presented on filling our emotional cups for ATA. Your specific segment was on your 4 steps to behavioral wellness. So can you tell the listeners of the show what these 4 steps are and why they're so important for you?
Yes, definitely. The 4 steps to behavioral wellness are nutrition, communication, exercise, and enrichment. It's something that I came up with when I was working in Colorado with in-person clients, particularly the veterinary office that I was working out of. I was seeing that these pet dog clients of mine, and I say pet dog to just differentiate between my sport clients and the pet dog clients, so non-sport dogs, were, you know, our behavior modification plans for them would always plateau if these 4 things were not also in place. And it actually stems from my personal odyssey with mental health. It really came from learning what I needed to be to not be a person with behavior problems. So when we look at, you know, we look at dogs and we say they have behavior problems, I want to say, you know, if this was a person, we would say this person has a mental health concern, and that there are, rather than saying they have behavior problems. And that's not to say that all people working with humans are like elevated and using right language, because certainly I think that's more adults, people who are working with adults who have behavior problems, they say they have mental health concerns. I think in children, too many people still use the phrase behavior problems. But my personal odyssey in mental health has led me to these 4 things that I then just translated into dogs, and the results have been so positively reinforcing to me that I continue to put them in place. And when I came up with it, it was just kind of born of my own head and my own odyssey. But then I turned to the Dr. Susan Friedman's Humane Hierarchy for dog trainers or for animal trainers, and realize that the very first step, the bottom rung on that hierarchy where you're supposed to begin, is actually this. It is the wellness kind of piece. So you're supposed to make sure that the animal is psychologically and physically well before you get started in your behavior modification. And I think that the problem is that most people, myself included, before I went down this path, would look at that and go, okay, we got to make sure there's no health problems, right? We got to make sure this dog isn't ill. And then we go from there. So we make sure they're not ill. And wellness is not the same as being not sick. And so that's where I kind of got deeper on it and decided, you know, these 4 things are the things that make us well, or the things that make them also able to be well. So I also have a story that I think is important. So much later, so I'd been doing this about 10 years when I first went to the ranch and that's the Karen Pryor. I think it's the Karen Pryor National Training Center is kind of the official. I don't know. Everybody calls it the ranch. Doesn't matter. It's here. It's like a 2.5 hour drive from where I live, which is pretty incredible. So I was there learning from Ken Ramirez, and he was talking about why wellness has to come first always. And he was talking about how we always have to make sure that the animals are cared for in the best possible way before we start training. And then that the first training we should do is to feed into this wellness rather than to meet our personal goals. And I just had this huge, I just felt very validated that Ken Ramirez shared the same mindset that I did as far as the animals need and deserve to have all of their basic needs fully, fully met before we try to kind of manipulate their behavior to fit them into our needs. So if you want, I'll just dive in to what the four things are. So the first one, nutrition. I'm not a vet and I'm not a nutritionist, so I don't tell anybody how specifically to feed their dogs. I will share anecdotal stories about diet changes that have helped client dogs as well as my own. But I basically encourage people to just consider this step always. So if I'm consulting with, sometimes I consult with other professional dog trainers on what they're doing. And if I ask them, and what is this dog eating when we're discussing a case, and they've worked with this dog for 3 weeks and they don't know, that's a problem to me. So it needs to be a question that we ask, and then it needs to be something that we pay attention to. So, and it will feed into the entire wellness of the dog. So if the dog looks physically healthy, that's kind of one place to start. Is not itchy, does not have kind of chronic health concerns that sometimes are nutrition pointed. You know, these are just things to think about, because if the animal is not fed well, then, you know, nothing else really works. And we're talking about this more and more with people as well in the mental health realm, that feeding the body appropriately, a shocker, actually matters for mental health. So I just want people to pay attention to it and kind of give themselves their own education as far as what the dog as a species should probably be eating to feed it best. And then, you know, I live in a house with 7 dogs who all sort of eat a little different, because it's important to recognize the individual as well. So most of what I'll say on nutrition is that people should think about it, try to get an education in it as much as they can, and they should be discussing it with their clients for sure. And then communication, I mean, that's like what everything at ATA is all about, right? So it's communicating better with our learners. And so on the communication front, I like to, you know, first of all, talk to people about kind of clean training mechanics and clean reinforcement procedures. And those are big things that we go into with my sport trainers in particular. With the pet dog owners that I was working with, this looked like this. It looked like 2 different things. One was Kathy Sadeo's Smart Times 50 that she wrote about in her Plenty and Life is Free book. Smart Times 50 is just that, it stands for C-Mark and Reinforced Training. And it just means that you see the dog do something that you like, you mark it in some way, and then you reinforce. And that your goal is to do that 50 times a day. When I heard about Smart Times 50, it allowed me to streamline and present what I wanted people to do in such an easy way. And so I immediately started having all my pet dog clients do it. And it just, the feedback I was getting was very positive. And the reason that it's times 50 from Kathy herself is that you always tell them to do a little bit more than you maybe think they're going to do. So they're like shooting high. So some of my people would say, oh my gosh, I only got 40 kibbles fed today. And I'll be like, that's awesome. You paid that dog 40 times for doing things that you want to see continue. That's awesome. And in fact, if they only do it 10 times, that's an enormous improvement on the fact that before they were just yelling at the dog when the dog didn't do the right stuff. So Smart Times 50 has been a big communication piece for me and my clients. And I do it. I have jars of kibble all around my house, and I actually just mark the dogs by name because there are seven of them, and then, and then feed them. And it's, I'm speaking to you in my office with two dogs asleep on beds because I have a cookie jar here and I do periodically throw food at them for being on a bed. And so they all come in and they go on the bed. And I didn't, you know, sometimes training is just that simple, that you just set up the environment for the dog to kind of want to do the thing, and then you pay them for doing it because they're the comfiest places to be in the room. And then the other piece is something that I created for my clients, and I call it I plus R, and it just stands for instruct and reinforce. So this is supposed to replace daily household corrections. So I find that, and myself included, if you don't have something else to do to make the dog stop doing the thing, you yell or you run in and startle or you whatever to make them stop doing the thing. And the bottom line is that we can't just tell people to stop doing that without giving them a replacement behavior for themselves, right? Because again, we have to help these people just like we help the animals in front of us. So I plus R is just you see the dog doing something you don't want them to do. Interrupt them with instructions. So ask them specifically to do something else and then pay them for doing it. So Smart Times 50 and I plus R are kind of my two big household communication changes that I help all of my people adopt. And when I'm being my best self, I adopt it really well. And I think that's important. And then the really, really cool thing is that there are platforms like ATA where if people want more than that, they can go, because there's all this great information because of the internet, because of social media, that people have access to now for better communication. And then exercise, I'm kind of known for the term decompression walk. So I'm really into providing dogs with what I would call species appropriate exercise. If you observe this species in the wild, which is usually in and amongst cities and villages in a lot of different places in the world, you see an animal that kind of rotates between scavenging and walking and sleeping. And we, I think, kind of expect them to mostly do the sleeping part. And we have selectively bred a lot of them to do that more. And that's great. They're usually not sport dogs, though. And so that's usually not the dogs that I'm working with. Because if they're lovely and perfectly happy to sleep 12 hours a day and then go, or sorry, 12 hours during the day and then maybe 8 hours at night. And then, you know, satisfied with a quick leash walk around the neighborhood, they're probably not a great sport candidate, because they need to have a little more get up and go than that. So I am big on dogs being allowed to move their bodies freely in nature. And being in nature itself, so meaning getting off concrete, being on dirt, being under tree cover, is actually, there's a growing body of research in human mental health about how vital it is and how important it is to us. And then I think about them and I think, well, if it's really important to us, and we think of ourselves as pretty highly evolved to live in cities and things like that, if it's still actually really important to us for our mental health, then it's got to be really, really important to them. And just anecdotally, when I actually get people to do this, so to take their dogs out to move freely in nature, and I like that to be off leash. If that's not possible, a long line and a harness, so a non-restrictive body harness and a long line can also suffice for sure. And it is very country specific. In the United States, we're pretty anti dogs off leash. So that's why this is a tough pill to swallow for a lot of my clients in the US. And then I have clients in Wales who are like, what do you mean? Take them for an off leash walk. I already do that twice a day. Like, doesn't everybody? And so it's interesting to me how different it is. And the last time I was in New Zealand, at lunch, I was going out for a walk every day because we were next to this great trail. And one day at lunch, like most of the people with participating dogs in the seminar were out with their dogs off leash on the trail. And it was so fantastic to see that, you know, everybody was pretty comfortable with that. And all the dogs handled each other really, really nicely, even though at least half of them, the people would say, oh, no, he's got some issues with other dogs. And I just said this would never happen in the United States. Like, the taking a lunch break and having everybody have their dog off leash on the trail would never happen. And I'm sure that there are people in the States listening who are like, that's my nightmare, and I would not participate in this. And so I wouldn't ask those people to. But getting your dog out in nature on dirt, under tree cover, in the woods, on the beach, in a field, is something that you will not understand the effect that it has on them until you actually devote yourself to doing it and you see the behavioral changes. So my dog Felix in particular needs this kind of exercise really badly, and all level of, you know, filling the other four, or I'm sorry, the other three steps to behavioral wellness for him will not be able to do, you know, what I want it to do if this element is not here. And so for another dog, the nutrition element might be what's vital. And for another dog, it might be the communication element that changes everything for them. But for my dog Felix, and for a lot of the dogs that I work with, this small change makes a world of difference as far as trying to address their problematic behavior, because a lot of times it just goes away. And then finally, we have enrichment. And enrichment, it's exciting to me that the pet dog owning world and the sport dog owning world are starting to really embrace this, because it's something that I've seen embraced kind of in the zoological community for a long time. And so what I like to say to people is, if your dog, you know, picture the last time you went to a zoo and picture an exhibit, an outdoor exhibit with maybe some indoor, you know, components, and it's relatively big. And now picture that your dog lives in that exhibit and that's their life. And now think of what you would need to provide them in that exhibit for you to feel like they were actually, you know, mentally satisfied being in there. And this kind of throws people, because they don't like to think of their dog being in an exhibit. And then my question is always, but why? Why don't you like that? Because if you leave your dog at home in your house for 8 hours while you go to work, they essentially are in an exhibit. It's just that nobody's looking at them. That's the difference. So basically, respecting that they are a hunter-scavenger species and they want to be doing that kind of thing, and that they are intelligent and have, you know, seek control over their own outcomes just like everything else does. Then I think about providing them with enrichment that kind of satiates all of those things for them. So food-based enrichment is where we all kind of tend to go in our minds. So the first and most simple thing we can do is not feed them out of a plain bowl, but feed them out of some kind of puzzle, a puzzle bowl, a Kong, or some other kind of puzzle toy. So that's like the first place we can go. So we can say, this dog has a daily caloric intake need. And rather than just handing them those calories and having them just consume them and now it's over, we can encourage them to hunt and scavenge and do dog things to eat their food. So food-based enrichment is big. And as far as meeting people where they are, if you're feeding out of a plain bowl, a really easy thing to do is just swap that out for a puzzle bowl. So some kind of, you know, a lot of times they look like a maze or a labyrinth or something like that. And so just swapping out those bowls is a nice first easy step. And when people feel good about that and it's easy for them, then I give them the next step, which is, now one of the meals is stuffed in a rubber toy that is then frozen. So Kongs and Tupples and all of those toys that there's so many of them on the market now that you can stuff with food and freeze, or just stuff with food plainly if the dog isn't going to work on it frozen. So then we get them to feeding, you know, two meals in different puzzle situations. And then, you know, when people start to see, you know, I think people just, they feel good about it and then they want more. So from there, I like to give the dog more of what I would call an actual puzzle, which is where something that they've got to shred or dig through or hunt through to get their food. And I would do that with kind of extras. So cardboard box with brown paper in it, and you just scatter some kibble in there and kind of start with that. And something that I hear a lot is, well, my dog won't do that. My dog won't do puzzles. And when that happens, we always have to return to splitting. There are dogs who will not at first. And it's really, really important with puzzles to make sure the dog is successful from minute one. So you always give them a puzzle that they can do. Because if I've never put together, say, a jigsaw puzzle, and you give me a 5,000 piece, you know, ridiculous art scene with no box to look at, so I don't even know what I'm making, I'm going to give up. I'm not going to want to do it. And then you go, well, Sarah's not good at puzzles. Whereas if I've never done a jigsaw puzzle, you probably want to give me like super basic 5 pieces and I have something to look at. Then you give me a harder one. Then you give me a harder one. And as my reinforcement history builds for puzzling, you can make it more and more difficult. And it's the same with your dogs. So if you're presenting them with food-based enrichment and they're just not eating, it's too hard. You just need to make it a little bit easier. And creativity in puzzling is important. And my little soapbox for 1 second is that we're all creative beings. So if somebody told you at some point that you're not creative, that's garbage. Because what separates us from all other species is that we create. So that's in you already. So just whatever somebody told you in like 7th grade art class, just get over it and start creating with puzzles, because you'll be so reinforced, because your dog will love these games and it'll be so cool for them. So food-based enrichment is big, and I think that they should be, there's that word again. They do best with food-based enrichment for the majority of their caloric intake. I like to make sure that they have a lot of puzzling opportunities. And I find that it helps them in so many different areas. I've watched dogs get more confident. Our friend Annie Thorne that you mentioned at the top, she and I have talked a lot about boosting her dog Wally's confidence with puzzling. And now you should see this dog tear through any challenge that's presented in front of him with a puzzle. And it's allowed him to also be able to deal with very triggering, scary things in his life. So if she has builders at her house working on something outside, that's really hard for him. But he can go in the living room and have a puzzle and feel chill about it because of his strong reinforcement history for puzzling. And then there's other enrichment things, though. So it doesn't stop with food-based enrichment. And I think too often that is where it stops for a lot of people. But I also like to present just novelty as a form of enrichment. So I like to present my dogs with different puzzles, so rotating puzzles. So if you mix up what you're giving them, and that alone, presenting them with novelty is important. Don't go crazy on the novelty if your dog's a little worried about new things, right? So again, building that reinforcement history. And I like to just, you know, present them with a new toy or rotate the toys and the chewies that are available all the time. So I do have like a toy bucket with a bunch of things in it that they have access to all the time. But when you rotate things out or just occasionally put a new one down in the bottom, and then you're really upping that play-based enrichment, because they'll go, "Ooh, I found a new thing." And then, you know, we'll go running around the house playing with it. So presenting novelty and play-based enrichment, meaning presenting them with those new toys, and maybe just getting them to play with you with a toy or without a toy. I'm ridiculous with my dogs and, you know, constantly, you know, engaging in just little fun games with them. So play-based enrichment, because they are a species that plays throughout life, rather than just as babies, which a lot of species do. So I've heard, but they play forever. So offering play-based enrichment so that they do keep playing, I think, is really important. And then I think that we forget, because we are not a scent-based species and they are. So we forget to also utilize that, because I think it's fair to say that much of their world is scent-based. Whereas we don't understand what that's like, and we can't understand what that's like. I don't remember who said this, but the best way that I've heard it described is if you could imagine that every scent in the room was a shred of color in the air, now you're starting to understand how much they're taking in and processing through scent all the time, because we are sight-based. So if you present it like that, you can start to understand how much they're processing through scent. So providing scent-based enrichment is also interesting and important. You can definitely do that through nose work training. There is a reason that nose work is skyrocketing in popularity, because dogs pretty universally enjoy it, and humans find it relatively easy to train. And especially if, you know, if you want to compete, then you want to get some precision behaviors in there and that kind of thing. Or if you're a training nerd like you and I, Ryan, then you might train your nose work very, very precisely and then that's why it's enriching to us. But I used to do, you know, back when I was working with in-person clients, I used to provide enrichment by just teaching a dog to find a cookie under a thing. So just put out four boxes and there's a cookie in one and they find it and I open the box and I give it to them. And then I make it more difficult and more difficult and more difficult. So scent-based enrichment, like finding something, a cookie or a toy that you've hidden, is huge. And then I have also encouraged people, and some people are going to be weirded out by this, to provide scent-based enrichment outside in their yards by, here in the US, you can purchase animal urine, different animal urine odors for hunting purposes, and you can put them out in your yard. And some clients have reported that their dogs sniff hard and they sniff for a while when we do that. No one has so far reported the dogs being afraid. So that's good. Because anytime I hear that, then you got to like throw caution to the wind. I never want to induce fear in anybody. But so far that hasn't happened. I originally, I didn't come up with it. A veterinarian that I used to work with told me about it because it's something that she had tried for just backyard barking. She had a dog that was deaf and would literally just stand in the backyard and bark to kind of entertain himself. And so she tried this, like, spreading animal urine around the corners and the perimeters of her backyard. And now, instead of standing there barking, he's scenting when he's outside. And so now we've engaged him in a task that is enriching to him. And so he's doing that instead of the thing that we don't like. And then I have a friend who works at a zoo in the big cat exhibits, and she told me that sometimes they literally just put perfume, different kinds of perfume, out in the outdoor exhibit for the cats to go out and sniff, and that she observes, you know, not all of them do, but some of them go up and they sniff it and they get interested in it and they might rub on it, and it's just kind of, we don't think about their olfactory experience because it's not ours, but we should think of it a little bit more and provide them with kind of more what I would call scent-based enrichment. So those are the four steps, and those are my kind of key recommendations on each of them.
I think I plus R sounds like the Apple version of positive reinforcement. which stands for innovation, right?
Yeah, the Apple exactly.
As a brand stands for innovation.
That's right.
And I like your input there about being creative. It reminded me of a Facebook post that Carrie Kish shared with me, and it said, remember, people say that they their ideas are stupid and they don't want to say them, and I think that's a big challenge with being creative is we don't actually offer the ideas because we're afraid of being shot down. But the Facebook post said, remember that someone somewhere once said, let's make a movie about a tornado and full of sharks.
and it was made, and it was, I think,
five
made
times.
So yeah, I was gonna say how many times. A lot of times. It's true, you just need to remember that. And it's kind of it's a big deal to me because I run into it a lot with my trainers that I work with, is that I think if they felt safer in creativity, they could have solved their own problems, actually. They wouldn't have needed my help because they had the skills and they had the knowledge and they were afraid to create the plan. And I think that when I watch really excellent trainers that I really respect, what I see that makes them stand out to me is not their vast experience and it's not their vast knowledge. It is their ability to apply creativity to the problem to solve it. And we all have it. We just, at some point, learned to quit using it.
Agree. So thanks for all of that. Nutrition, communication, exercise, and enrichment. Looking at the time, I'm curious to ask lots of questions, but I'm going to ask for what I'm going to label as a quick passion talk story.
Yep.
What is a story that sticks out in your mind? One story the most from your experience of kind of developing this framework and having it at the forefront of your mind when you're in front of a client and a dog. What is one more story that really sticks out to you?
All right. So quick story would be, I was working with a dog. It was an agility dog, a sport dog that was exhibiting all these behaviors that we like to throw the label arousal on. So barking, biting, body slamming of the handler on course and things like that. And his primary form of exercise, because he was this super high power dog, was to be taken on a short leash to a football field nearby, and the owner would just throw the chuck it ball. So just throw the ball until the dog is physically exhausted and then take him home. And when I met her, when we really started digging into this dog and what he needed, I asked her to stop doing that. And I asked her to instead walk him off leash in the mountains as much as she could. And that was really hard for her to hear, but she trusted me and she was a really excellent student and she did it. And the speed at which this dog's demeanor changed and his life changed and her life and her connection to him changed in such a way that, you know, it was no longer about getting into the sport and kicking everybody's butt. It was instead about how cool is this dog that I get to share my life with? And we go and we climb a mountain. And then if we want to play agility, we do. But all of his behaviors at home that were problematic, like he had a lot of what we would call compulsive behaviors, meaning he would snap at invisible flies and stare at air vents and things like that, disappeared with the exercise component. And just kind of understanding that we think a lot of the time when we have these really high power sport dogs that we need to make them physically tired. Understanding that that isn't actually my goal, because first of all, you're probably just going to build stamina and you really don't need to. And second of all, I like to say if I spend an entire day in air travel, when I get to my hotel at night, I am exhausted, but it does not feel good. And a lot of times my sleep is not good. But if I spend the entire day hiking and I get home at night, I'm exhausted and it feels good and my sleep is good. So what is the difference? The difference is that in one scenario, I am physically and mentally taxed. And in the other scenario, meaning that I was faced with things that were hard for me for an entire day and my stress hormones kept going up and down and up and down. And in the other scenario, I was simply allowed to move my body until my body felt tired without a lot of stress and without a lot of things that are hard, and with a lot of just kind of breathing and being in a natural setting. And now I feel tired and it feels good. And the goal needs to be, or should, or, you know, we want it to be for my clients to help the dog feel tired in a way that feels good to them rather than make the dog feel tired in a way that works for you because they are physically spent and probably emotionally spent, if we could ask them, from chasing this ball that's really important to them. So that's one of my big standouts.
Awesome. And been connecting a lot of dots as you've been talking today. I think I've been using the humane hierarchy for years and constantly looking at that wellness part, addressing it, but not really having spent time unpacking it and defining it as much as we've done in this podcast today. And also then thinking about using Susan Friedman's functional assessment and intervention design form, which I do a lot. The first questions are always, which I've been doing for years, asking about diet and the animal's exercise and space. And I've just gone, click,
exactly. Light bulb. Duh. Yes, totally. It's all the same stuff. And I think that we, especially in the dog training world, I think that those questions get skipped over a little too often because we feel pressure to deliver more than that. In like our first session, we feel all this pressure to fix everybody's problems right away. So we gloss over that, that first step on the hierarchy. And I think we're skipping something if we do that legitimately.
Well, fantastic that we get to have this opportunity and use this technology to have these conversations and podcasts and spread it around the world to people's ears. Because unlike you, Sarah, we're not all 2.5 hours away from Ken Ramirez's ranch.
So. I know, pretty lucky. I have to say I moved here first. But I was pretty excited when when the ranch popped up.
Hey, unfortunately, we are at towards the end of the episode. We do have one last question. Something that I just made a note of that I wanted to say at the start, but forgot, was congratulations on, you said you built a robust business, and me and you have talked about entrepreneurship before. And the reinforces and sometimes punishes that are involved with that. So I just wanted to, before I forget, say congratulations on everything that you've managed to be creative about and build. It's really awesome.
Thank you.
Last question is, looking into the future now, we've gone back to Sarah Streaming's early days. We've been brought up into everything that's fueling your fire now. But for this part of the episode, I want to look into the future. What do you really want to see happen? And maybe judging from the content of this episode, we might be able to hypothesize about what your answer is going to be here. But what do you really want to see happen over the next 5 to 10 years in the dog and positive reinforcement animal training world and people?
I think we mostly did cover it, but generally speaking, I think that what I would like is for these, all of these good principles, like the humane hierarchy, to be more widely known and accepted in the sport dog world. And then specifically, I really, really love it if the sport dog problem solving world actually did take these four steps into account before we start basically a behavior modification plan for a sport or performance issue. So rather than diving right in, your dog breaks their start line stay. Okay, well, here's a punishment protocol for that. I mean, that's typical, unfortunately. Rather than that, saying, okay, your dog has a start line stay problem. First, I need to ask you what he's eating. And then I need to ask you what his day-to-day looks like and what his exercise looks like. And let's have a look at your communication, not just in training, but also in your everyday with this dog. So taking that approach where we actually do start at the bottom and work our way up rather than starting with behavioral intervention. I think that's what I would like to see evolve.
Or maybe your behavioral intervention is starting at the bottom.
Completely, yes. Understanding that we can start at the bottom and should.
This episode's been an odyssey.
Yes.
Thank you again. So much for sharing everything today, Sarah. Just before we do officially wrap up, though, I know we've mentioned this already, but could you please just remind everyone listening where they can go to learn more, get in touch, listen to your show, etc.?
Yeah, thecognitivecanine.com is my website, and everything is there. My blog and my podcast are both there, as well as how to work with me and what my upcoming courses are. Cog Dog Radio is my podcast, and if you want to stay super up to date on everything that's happening, the Cog Dog Radio Facebook page, as well as the Cognitive Canine Facebook page, those would be the best. Liking those pages would be the best way to stay very up to date, because I am not great at updating my website, although I am working on it.
Although if you want to stay super duper, super duper up to date, then follow Sarah on Instagram.
Yep, cognitive_canine. Follow me on Instagram and then maybe I'll be more inclined to put content there. There's always pretty pictures of my dogs hiking in the woods, but that's about it.
This has become a social experiment, everyone. We're going to see from the frequency of Sarah's future behavior whether your engagement with her Instagram account is reinforcing for her. Hey, we'll link to all of this in the show notes as well. This has been so much fun, Sarah, from myself and on behalf of everyone listening. We really appreciate you taking the time to come and hang out with us today at Animal Training Academy. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ryan. It's been a blast.
We do, of course, really appreciate all of you tuning in today as well. And if you have enjoyed this episode and you were interested in carrying on the conversation about working with our animals in the most positive, funnest, choice-rich ways, then as mentioned at the start of this episode, the Animal Training Academy community is waiting for you. head on over to www.animaltrainingacademy.com and click on the membership button in the main menu to learn more about what members are describing as the Netflix social media platform for behavior geeks. There's something there for absolutely everyone, and we're looking forward to having you join the tribe. That's it for this episode, though. We're going to wrap it up there. Thanks again so much, everyone, for listening. You'll hear from us again soon.